Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. It's our 40th episode. It's been exciting to see our growth over the past 40 episodes, and I want to thank you because we've had so much support. We have a lot packed into today's show. It was a busy week. We are talking water. We have more on that Fresno Bee report that looked at the Foster Farms COVID outbreak. And also the House and Senate Ag Committees both had hearings Thursday. We're reporting on both. To start, we get right to our top story, water in California. The State Water Project announced it would cut its water allocation in half to 5%. And the Federal Central Valley Project said it would delay delivery of its 5% allocation to ag customers south of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. Also, the State Water Board has warned water rights holders to plan for potential shortages. Joining me on the phone now is William Bordeaux, the chairman of the California Water Alliance. So once again, we got some news about California water allocations this week. The Department of Water Resources announcing that it's cutting its initial 10% in half down to 5%. And it seems that this is something that we, you know, if you're Californian long enough, you hear this very often. Can you start off with just telling me what's your initial reaction to hearing that?
Well, I would think the morale in our country is at the lowest of my lifetime. This pandemic, this global pandemic, has really strained just the average worker and how to run a business. And then when you cut off our capability to have a domestic food supply, it really is devastating. And so the government should be doing everything they can to make sure that we have a strong and vibrant domestic food supply capability, particularly in times of stress like we find ourselves in. And you could easily reduce the outflow requirements for the benefit of fish and balance the needs of ecosystems with human needs.
Okay, and that's what I was going to ask you, or that's along the lines of what I wanted to ask next, was if in a dry year, we only have so much water coming in, how can we make that work better in your view?
Well, we're really blessed. We have the Sierra Nevada, we have snowpack, but we also need to be using the infrastructure that our fathers and grandfathers built for us that we haven't been maintaining and we've let become dilapidated, and then we mismanage it. And so last year when we did have rainfall and snowpack in abundance, we should have captured more of that water and saved it for human needs. And so it's all about looking out into the future and using what resources and infrastructure we have at our disposal. We also need to invest in that infrastructure, but there needs to be a balance, and we need to make sure human needs are part of that equation.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me, and I'm a reporter, I'm not a water expert, so please tell me when I am wrong, but it seems to me that the water situation in California is something that when we're talking about it today, when we're talking about today's water, it's too late. We need to be talking about the water 5 years from now and how we're using that water or how we're storing that water. We know dry years happen. You know, we know that California gets very dry, but we also know there are years when it's not dry. What do we need to be doing now so that we don't have this? Or what should we have been doing 20 years ago? You mentioned it, part of it, you know, with upkeep and storage. What do you think we should be doing now?
Well, we need to be modernizing the Endangered Species Act so it helps the environment but also frees up water for human needs. And so we need real-time management. We need to be holding the environmental community accountable for huge amount of resources that are dedicated for the betterment of the environment. We need to actually improve the environment. We need to not just turn a blind eye and say, well, the Endangered Species Act says you have to do it. The Endangered Species Act should succeed and should be saving the smelt and the salmon. It should just not be wasting and spending billions of dollars. We only have a limited amount of resources, and we're smart enough. American ingenuity can solve any problem if we put our minds to it. But do we want it? We have to want to solve the problem. There are lots of people out there that use this problem as a way to build a career.
So thinking about the Endangered Species Act, I was raised in the Fresno area, and I can remember being a child, and I'm nowhere near a child now, but I can remember being a child and hearing farmers talking about things like the Delta smelt and how that was affecting farm issues such as water. Now, I was young. I was 8 or 9 or maybe right around then when I my first memories of this. And like I said, it's been a few decades now. Why has this not been changed?
Well, government is a very slow and difficult process. And then you have to have a bipartisan agreement. This is going to require everybody coming together and wanting to solve this problem for the betterment of society. And I do think our elected officials should be working across the aisle on important issues like this. And it's sad that we've been trying to help the smelt for so many years, allocating so much water to their benefit, and their populations have dwindled. That's not considered success in my book. We've decimated the farms. We have tons of fallow ground, and the smelt are near extinct.
So looking at the problem that we're facing now immediately, and I have said that water, when we talk about water issues, a lot of it is long-term. But when we look now and the waters, the farmers and what they're facing now with such a small allocation, and hopefully it doesn't get any smaller, what can we do right now?
Well, you can't really manage a business without one of your primary inputs. And so it's sad and going to be devastating for my community. And there are going to be people that lose their job. There are going to be people that lose their livelihoods on top of coming through one of the most difficult periods in my lifetime with this global pandemic. And so this government, the governor and the president, should be supporting these communities.
Correct me if I'm wrong again, but I'm hearing you say that it really needs to go beyond just our local lawmakers.
Oh, absolutely. The governor and the State Water Resource Control Board, the Bureau of Reclamation, NOAA Fisheries, the Department of Interior, and those individuals that are oversee those agencies need to be engaged. Some of them are. There are great people that work in these agencies. But they're large bureaucracies that are very difficult to move. And we find ourselves in an emergency situation. Mm-hmm. Action is needed.
Our primary audience is California farmers, but we do have a secondary audience, which is farmers around the nation. And if you could tell the farmers around the nation something about what our farmers are facing with water, what would you want them to know, or what do you want them to understand?
I want them to understand that we're all in this together. We need to stand shoulder to shoulder and have each other's back, because what we're trying to do is important for society. And we should be proud of our accomplishments and all that we've done, and how we've produced more with less and become efficient and done a bunch of wonderful things with the use of technology. But we all must work together, and it's not just farmers, just citizens in general. There's more that we can agree on than disagree on, and I do think we need to find common ground and work together for a common solution on many issues. Water supply is top of mind of ours, but I'm sure there's many issues and challenges that we all face. But we can overcome them if we continue to have a positive, optimistic outlook, and we have the support of our leaders.
And I maybe should have asked you this first, but can you tell me a little bit about the California Water Alliance?
Well, we're a nonpartisan organization that advocates for a reliable water supply for municipalities, the environment, and agriculture.
All right. And is there anything that you think that we missed, anything I should have asked you that I didn't?
Not that I can think of. I think you did a fabulous job, and I think it's important that this topic is discussed, because people's lives are being impacted significantly, and our food supply capability is under stress, our domestic food supply capability. And we've learned during this pandemic that the supply chains can be broken. If other countries start looking inward and we're relying on them for our food, we become vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there are many, many areas that we became vulnerable. I think some of our medicine, some of our critical inputs, lots of things that we need to take a close look at and make sure that we can take care of ourselves if we have to.
Right.
Doesn't mean we shouldn't be having trading partners, but we should be, in the event of emergency, a war, famine, pandemic, we should be able to take care of ourselves. And I think we can, but it's going to take cooperation, innovation, and planning.
Now, on a final note, is there anything that our listeners that you think they can do to help get the water situation heard better by the people who make the laws?
Absolutely. Contact your elected officials and let them know that you think that having a reliable water supply for the San Joaquin Valley is important. And maybe some people don't. And if they don't, they should educate themselves on the critical importance that this very valuable national resource contributes to not only the state of California, but to society in general. And I'm not trying to discount the other farmers that are in the north or the south or wherever you may be. I support all those farmers, but we find ourselves in a critical situation right now.
Thank you again to William Bordeaux, chairman of the California Water Alliance. Our news brief is coming up next. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Here's your news brief for today. The ACP HLB San Joaquin Valley Task Force has a request of citrus growers in Kern County. Consider treating all your citrus blocks in Kern County, especially if they're located east and south of Bakersfield. They say that includes non-bearing trees and blocks not normally treated at this time. They say to use an ACP effective insecticide next time you are treating the block, and the sooner the better. A Citrus Insider email sent yesterday afternoon by the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Program on behalf of the San Joaquin Valley Task Force states last fall and early this year, there was a significant number of Asian citrus psyllid trap detectors in Kern County, more than 100, they said. The detections were in residential properties as well as commercial citrus areas in Kern County, especially the city of Bakersfield and areas south and east of it. Live breeding populations of ACP were discovered by CDFA survey crews in both residential and commercial citrus. The detection areas were treated, but they say there is significant concern low-level ACP populations may still exist undetected. It's a long and complex undertaking to fill the many vacant appointed positions at USDA. Gary Crawford reports.
The Agriculture Department has hundreds of job slots currently unfilled. These are positions which are appointed by the administration, positions like the state directors of the Farm Service Agency. So when will those jobs be filled?
Well, if it were up to me and me alone, we'd have those done by now, but it's not up to me.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack telling farm broadcasters each of those appointed positions for USDA and for many other departments have to go through the Presidential Personnel Office. Currently, there are about 4,000 positions to fill, and they've had 50,000 people apply. Plus, Vilsack says there's a lot more involved than just hiring someone.
There's a lot of vetting and a lot of review to make sure that you're getting the right people. There are a lot of interests that have to be reached out to. It's not just what I think state directors should be for FSA in the state of Iowa. There are a lot of folks who have input in that, as they should.
And so to fill the vacant USDA positions,
it's going to take a while.
Hopefully within a couple of months, he says, positions will start being filled. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Agriculture groups applaud the Department of Agriculture for this week's announcement of plans to distribute more than $12 billion under the pandemic assistance for producers. The funding includes $6 billion to develop new programs or modify existing proposals using remaining discretionary funding from the Consolidated Appropriations Act. Another $5.6 billion will be directed to formula payments to cattle producers and eligible flat rate or price trigger crops. American Farm Bureau Federation President Zippy Duval says, quote, We appreciate Secretary Vilsack's action to release funds and expand eligibility for Farmers HIT. National Farmers Union President Rob LaRue says, quote, "This sensible approach will help farmers who have previously been excluded from relief programs and keep them in business." The aid programs include biofuels, which previously were excluded from relief packages. Despite the challenges for U.S. beef exporters related to the COVID-19 pandemic, shipments overseas have been strong. Here's Rod Bain.
Earlier this month, Japan announced a temporary 30-day increase in tariffs on U.S. beef imports as the amount of U.S. beef product triggered a safeguard built into the Phase 1 U.S.-Japan trade agreement. That safeguard trigger and related tariff hike really didn't come as much of a surprise for members of the beef industry. Kent Bacchus of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association explains with
increase in sales into Japan. We had the Japanese agreement that kicked in and leveled the playing field for us.
In fact, from the start of the trade deal back on January 1st of last year, over 242,000 metric tons of U.S. beef have been exported to Japan. Perhaps more impressive has been the volume of sales to not just Japan, but other markets in the middle of a global pandemic. Dan Hallstrom of the U.S. Meat Export Federation says, like other sectors in agribusiness, COVID-19 has forced adoption of new methods to meet and make sales of products, especially overseas.
The consumption of food service has been hit. But what's happened is we've seen consumption shift, and the obvious shift is into retail. Retail's been booming globally as it was in the U.S.
However, global consumers of U.S. beef have continued to show their demand for product via online sales.
This home meal replacement boom, this ready-made delivery of meals boom, this was well in place and already on a very steep trajectory upwards in places like Taiwan and Korea pre-COVID. So once COVID hit, all that did was just expedite that demand factor by 5 or 6 or 7 times. And we're just seeing these delivery platforms just boom.
NCBA's Kent Bacchus says education of beef product and preparation during the pandemic has been similar abroad as it has been domestically.
We've really tried to dial in our messaging to teach them how to maximize that beef eating experience at home. And because of that, we really haven't seen some of the losses that other protein and other countries have seen.
Market access and development through organizational efforts, as well as collaborations with USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service, have also been different over the past year. USMEF's Dan Hallstrom explains.
We're still conducting seminars. Some of them are in person. In the places where they're not open, we're doing online virtual seminars, online receptions with the trade, and things like this.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's your news brief for today. When we come back, backlash from the Foster Farms COVID outbreak. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
The California Latino Legislative Caucus held a virtual news conference Thursday to discuss the recent Fresno Bee investigative report about the COVID-19 outbreak at the Foster Farms facility in Fresno. The report found dozens of emails that showed that during the outbreak, health officials, quote, tipped off company executives about a Cal OSHA inspection, coordinated media talking points during the crisis, withheld information from the public, and issued no corrective actions. That again published in the Fresno Bee. Hundreds of people were infected in that outbreak. At least 5 died. Bobby Singh Dillon is the son of one of those people who died. He spoke at Thursday's news conference.
I just want to say a few words about my father and the whole incident that happened this past December. My father, Baljinder Singh Dhillon, was an amazing father who worked hard to provide for his family. He worked tirelessly since 1979, working 70 plus hours a week for the past four decades. 25 of those 41 years he spent at Foster Farms. He was dedicated to his job and his duties at Foster Farm. He had plans to retire at the end of December of 2020 and enjoy the fruits of his labor. Unfortunately, he contracted COVID virus from Foster Farms in early December, and his battle with COVID lasted 22 days and it took his life. Recently, the Fresno Bee reported the story of Fresno County health officials and Foster Farm having ties and providing advance notice of inspections. After reading the story, we felt that both Foster Farms and Fresno County are not being transparent about the severity and scale of this outbreak. We already have paid the ultimate price of losing our father, but there should be accountability from Foster Farms as they have failed their workers by not providing a safe work environment. We humbly request that these ties between health officials and employers be investigated. The truth of the outbreak needs to be revealed for the sake of getting closure. And I thank you all for being involved and getting us the closure that we really, really need.
State Assemblyman Joaquin Arambula, a Democrat from Fresno, is a member of the caucus and also spoke during the news conference.
Thank you very much, Assemblymember Rivas, as well as Senator Durazo. Both as chair and vice chair of the Latino Caucus, you have provided the urgency and attention to this issue that it is needed, and really appreciate your ability to pull together this press conference and all of the attention that you've brought to it. But I feel that I must remind us that during this outbreak, that the COVID-19 pandemic was at its deadliest. And according to the Manuela Tobias story, this was the biggest known COVID-19 workplace outbreak we had in Fresno County. And it was being investigated at the Foster Farms plant on Cherry Street in Fresno. And we know that this horrible virus has disproportionately killed and affected Latinos and other ethnic minorities. And I must remind you that most of the workers at Foster Farms are people of color. And so this bee story does raise disturbing questions about trust. If a county public health department is more concerned about helping a business owner rather than safeguarding the health and well-being of people who work at this business, what are we to think? It raises questions about whether components of the Fresno health safety system have been compromised and possibly biased towards employers. And we need to know whether or not this is a single incident or an indication of something that is more widespread. And so I agree that an investigation is needed to help us to restore trust in this system. As a physician, I know that for you to take care of your patients, those patients must know that you are doing everything you can to help them. As elected officials, we must do the same for every constituent that we serve. They must know that their public health officials are protecting workers. I would point out in the Fresno Bee editorial, they reminded us that it is the Fresno County Department of Public Health, not the Fresno County Department of Corporate Health. We must ensure that our public health officials have both the trust and interest of all Californians, especially our most vulnerable.
Assemblyman Robert Rivas of Hollister is the co-chair of the caucus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Always great to see you. And I want to thank everybody for being with us this morning. Very proud to be vice chair of the California Latino Legislative Caucus. I represent the 30th Assembly District, also chair of agriculture in the State Assembly. You know, and first off, I want to thank the Fresno Bee and the reporter, Manuela Tobias, for her work in uncovering this truly, truly troubling event. You know, the Latino Caucus, our members have been deeply, we've been concerned about the health and safety of our state's agricultural workers, about our essential workforce. And since the start of this pandemic, we have been advocating for, we have been working for first worker protections and now vaccines to ensure an equitable distribution of vaccines across our state to our residents and to our populations that have been hardest hit in this state. And we've been fighting for these vaccines for this group of very vulnerable essential workers who we know have experienced the greatest health and economic disparities as a result of this pandemic. And our caucus has worked very closely with our governor and his administration to mitigate the disproportionate impact that COVID-19 has had on Latinos across the state. And so when we hear reports about Fresno officials have, that they have broken the trust of their community and have put the lives of our essential workers in jeopardy, it's a problem. And this morning, we are here to demand answers and to demand accountability. You know, the public, they deserve to know the truth of what exactly happened, of why it happened, and those responsible for any improper interactions with foster farms, they must be held accountable. You know, as government workers, we work for people and not corporations. And so, you know, significant some COVID-19 related laws and regulations that were adopted last session, a lot of that work from this caucus and from members of this caucus. But we, you know, worked on laws last session to provide workers with protective equipment, with frequent testing, with workplace safety enhancements. And so, you know, as the grandson of a farm worker, I am personally offended by the actions taken by these Fresno County health officials. These workers are multi-dimensional people. They have families. They have roots in our community, and the public. We deserve. They deserve answers. And so I'd like to, share my concerns and echo the statement of our chair and ask the governor's administration to initiate an investigation into improper actions that may have led to an increase some cases of COVID-19 or even some deaths.
They're asking for an investigation into the situation. Coming up next, the U.S. House and Senate Ag Committees both hold hearings. We'll give you the details right after this.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRite Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
Both the House and Senate Ag Committees met Thursday. The House discussed what Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack called the systemic racism and discrimination by the USDA perpetuated against Black farmers.
In the interest of time, and my belief that the testimony of the other panelists on this panel is far more relevant and more compelling than anything I would offer, I won't read my prepared statement, but would ask that it simply be placed in the record. What I wish to do today is to speak from the heart. And I want to provide you, Mr. Chairman, and members of this committee, a single and solemn commitment from me and from the team at USDA that we will, over the next 4 years, do everything we can to root out whatever systemic racism and barriers may exist at the Department of Agriculture directed at Black farmers, socially disadvantaged farmers, and people who live in persistently poor areas in rural America. Efforts have already been made in the past, as you have indicated, Mr. Chairman, good faith efforts to respond to specific acts of discrimination, but more needs to be done to dig deeper into the systemic causes and barriers that perpetuate discriminatory practices and to deal directly with the cumulative effect of discrimination, the gap that now exists between those who had the full array of services at USDA, the full array of programs at USDA, and those who for far too long have not had that array. Work has begun already to start with the implementation of President Biden's executive order on equity. A working group has been formed at USDA across all agencies, and they've already begun to meet and to begin the work of the assessment of services, benefits, contracts, and procurements, and barriers and problems that may exist. I will have the benefit of the guidance and direction for the first time ever of a senior advisor for equity in the Secretary's office. Dr. Dwayne Goldman has been appointed in that position, and he will work with our new team at the Civil Rights Office and with the dedicated men and women at USDA to provide advice and direction on equity issues throughout the USDA. And I certainly look forward to the day of Senate confirmation of Dr. Jule Bernard, who once confirmed will be the first African-American Deputy Secretary at the United States Department of Agriculture. She and I will partner together to carry out and fulfill the commitment that I made to you today. Finally, I'm grateful for your leadership, Mr. Chairman, and that of Chairman Bishop, Senators Booker, Warnock, and Warren, who helped to shepherd through the American Rescue Plan that contains an historic step forward in responding to the cumulative effect of discrimination in the past by providing debt relief for socially disadvantaged producers, by establishing an equity commission to review barriers that exist at USDA, to assist with heirs' property issues, expanded outreach, market development, and land access. These resources will help restore some balance in the USDA covenant relief approach and allow an external review of all of our programs at USDA. We're prepared to move quickly, efficiently, and thoughtfully to implement the American Rescue Plan sections related to Black farmers and socially disadvantaged farmers and other sections of the Rescue Plan that relate to rural America. As part of my commitment to you today, I also want to provide an additional guarantee, and that is I plan to have in place a system of rigorous reporting, accountability, and oversight in all of our equity efforts. Let me be clear, there is no place at the USDA for discrimination, none, nor for that matter, anywhere. This historic moment to advance equity must not be lost, and I intend to do everything I can to ensure that it isn't. Mr. Chairman, I look forward to the questions from the committee. At your pleasure.
Cedric Rowe, an organic farmer from Albany, Georgia, was one of the witnesses at the hearing.
I'm a first-generation farmer. I've been farming for 4 years on my own. I had the opportunity to graduate from a land grant institution that also taught me a little bit more about farming. And you know, my experience of it hasn't changed since the past. And hearing my granddaddy and older people talk about farming back in the day and how they wasn't able to access land and equipment, I'm going through that personally myself. I applied for beginner farmers program, microloans. The reason I didn't get funded, I don't know. I have legit reasons why I need the assistance, and also the red flags are still there because I'm giving them all of my information, all of my life, just for them to tell me no again. So it holds it back. It holds me back as a farmer. So when you I see the effort we're doing to allocate money for those programs, but are those programs actually funding these farmers, which they're not? Are these farmers taking advantage of those programs? We're not able to, because when you look at a Black farmer, you're thinking small. That's why we're on that 1%, 2% level. Speaking from my personal experience, it's just been hard to, you know, even get into the market with peanuts. As you know, peanuts is a commodity. And in order for you to grow peanut, a commodity, it sells itself. So as a Black farmer, I can't just take my peanuts to any peanut mill because they'll say, oh, we're full. They'll give me some excuse of why they can't take my peanuts. So as a young farmer, you know, I created my own avenue to create my own market, organic peanuts, something that I know large farmers can't compete with. That's why I stepped into another market like hemp. So I started doing more of organic, started focusing on the soil and the land, something that, you know, that we always focus on growing up. Take care of the land will take care of you. So, you know, being coming from that era and having that mentality, you know, even my little small piece of land, it matters just like a larger farmer. And I see to this day how money is being allocated to help out, you know, young and Black farmers and social disadvantaged farmers. But, you know, that it comes with so much just for that farmer to access that money. You look on the other hand, you know, it's easy for them to access money. They're they'll tell you I qualify for it, but when I get there, it's a whole nother story. So we need to change up, who qualifies and who doesn't. A lot of the black farmers miss out on opportunity to, keep the land in their family name. So they're forced to go get a loan from the government, which would, nine times 10 bring them, into more debt, because everyone knows farmers is a risk. Every year is not a profitable year, so farmers like me will look, in order for me to feel like the government is giving me the right assistance, it's funny how we have a pandemic, and during the pandemic, you have other banks and all that, they have forgiveness on their loans, but if, government, USDA have had loans out allocated for these farmers, but you never gave them options for the forgiveness so their family can keep that land in their name. Something to be able to show, with forgiveness, you have to show what you're doing, show how you at this one step and how it better you to the next step. So, I feel like we need to take more steps, and the people at the top need to focus more at the people at the bottom. And, just to leave with a scenario that something that I used to always tell people, the important person in the building is the janitor. We as black farmers are janitors. The top person that can be the principal or the president. If the president is not attuned with the janitor, it's not a good structure. So we need to make sure we build that structure from the top all the way bottom to the farmers. The people that's allocating this money need to know exactly who's using it, why they're using it, who really needs it. And I think it's a separation in between there, because it's a difference saying, we put money out there for you, but when we're not able to access it, it's more like saying, well, we put it there, it's up to you to get it. That's not hope. That's not giving a farmer or a black farmer any hope to be able to continue to hold on to what they had in their family. So, that was just some personal, stuff that I've been through that I can still see that hasn't changed within the system.
The Senate Ag Committee also held a meeting Thursday and discussed child nutrition. Senator Debbie Stabenow is the chairwoman of the committee.
I am so pleased to be here today to discuss how we create a healthier future for our children. I know this is something we all deeply care about. All parents want to see their children grow up to lead healthy and successful lives. One of the best ways to do that starts with the food on their plates. When those plates are empty, it's a crisis for the child, it's a crisis for the family, and it's a crisis, quite frankly, for our country. School meals were created because Congress recognized that far too many children were growing up malnourished. On the heels of World War II, that was a serious risk to our national security. WIC was established in response to the devastating impacts of poor nutrition on moms and babies. Summer meals were created because children were going hungry in between school years. At each of these turning points, Congress saw a crisis and acted. While a lot has changed since then, we need to take action again today. The COVID-19 pandemic has only exacerbated the dual challenge of obesity and hunger. Obesity rates for children have been on the rise for years, again creating calls for action from today's military leaders, pediatricians, public health experts. After the last year without recess or after-school sports, early evidence is showing that the pandemic has put more children at risk of obesity. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, who we will hear from today, children in low-income households and communities of color are more at risk of both obesity and COVID-19. At the same time, too many children in this country don't have enough to eat. Think about that. Too many children in the United States of America don't have enough to eat. One in four children in the United States now face hunger because of the pandemic. It's clear we are facing a child health crisis and a child hunger crisis. While the pandemic has created a new set of challenges, it has also created opportunities for us to improve children's lives. Whether they're learning in person or virtually, we know our children can't focus with an empty stomach. They need wholesome and nutritious breakfasts, lunches, snacks in order to learn and grow. During the pandemic, Congress gave schools new tools to reach more families in need, minimizing paperwork and focusing on creative ways to meet children where they are, whether it's delivering meals along bus routes, giving out a week's worth of meals at once, or providing a pandemic EBT card to help families purchase food in the grocery store. New tools helped schools reach more children in need. And while we all are happy to be beginning to move past this pandemic, we can apply these lessons in creative thinking to how we reach children during the summer, on weekends, and after school. As we transition back to in-person learning, we have to use all of the tools in our toolbox to feed our kids and reduce burdens on schools, daycare centers, and parents. It's also important to make sure families have healthy food for their children before they reach school age. The successful WIC program helps pregnant moms and babies eat healthy food in the critical first stages of life. Key investments in technology and modernization like telehealth, data sharing, even something as simple as text messaging can help us feed more people in need. It's been over 10 years since Congress last made improvements to our critical child nutrition programs. With all the challenges we face, it's time to take action on a bipartisan basis. Feeding kids is not and should not be a partisan issue. And I know my partner and my ranking member, Senator Bozeman, agrees. I look forward to passing a strong, bipartisan child nutrition bill that helps our kids get healthier, not hungrier.
Dr. Diane Golzinski is the director of the Office of Health and Nutrition Services for the Michigan Department of Education. She was one of the witnesses at the hearing.
Children simply should not have to wonder if they are going to be able to eat while at school. We must also provide a healthy breakfast at school in a manner which reduces stigma and increases the opportunities for children to participate. In talking with a local superintendent, he told me that the number of children in his district that qualify for free or reduced price meals was not high enough for him to do the work to even offer the program. He has over 1,000 students in his district that qualify. That's over 1,000 students that have no opportunity to eat breakfast at school, and that does not take into account the additional children whose families are too ashamed to apply or whose income are just above the threshold to qualify. Children should also not have to shoulder the burden of wondering if they are going to eat when school is not in session. Whether it be the weekends, school breaks, a natural disaster, a pandemic, or the summer months, we need a child nutrition program that can be immediately responsive and provide healthy meals that strives to meet the dietary guidelines. Lessons learned from non-congregate meals and parent pickup during the pandemic should guide a future revamp of that program. As families try to regain some sense of normal, go back to work, get caught up on rent and other payments, we must continue to be that glue for our children. Mental health and child hunger are realities of the pandemic that we should be addressing now and continue that support for years after the pandemic officially ends. Thank you for your continued support of the child nutrition programs. Thank you for maintaining high nutrition standards that teach our future generations ways to meet the dietary guidelines so that we can continue to tackle the diet-related diseases that plague our country. After all, we must be successful in nutrition because our future cannot be successful without it. Thank you.
Some public health advocates want to increase nutrition standards for school meals. That's our show for today. Don't forget, if you'd like to nominate a Farmer of the Week, you can send that nomination to me at sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.